Happy Saturday, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of The Crow's Nest. I'm Kelly J. Lewis, and with me, as always, is Thomas Ware III and Dr. Kevin Crow. Now, one of the things that's a hot topic lately is health insurance and the Affordable Care Act. We know a judge in Texas declared it unconstitutional at this point, so there are a lot of lawsuits that are coming up for it. And so we've been talking about kind of where's the next financial bubble going to be. Do we think it's healthcare? I mean, is this what we're seeing?
I still think it goes back to what we've had before, just in the banking already. And but the point is anytime you have any uncertainty, that may cause people to restrain their spending.
For sure.
Already. So again, even if it's not healthcare, just the uncertainty adds to when that bubble breaks.
Well, and on the insurance company side of it, I mean, should this thing be upheld, I mean, you're talking about taking out the mandatory coverage for pre-existing conditions. That's huge.
Well, here's what I've always said. Okay, I never was in favor of Obamacare. I was always opposed to it. It hurt us badly. But at the same time, I mentioned this, that even if you're going to get rid of it, which again, I'm for getting rid of it, but my fear is when you do stuff very quickly, in the midst of when people are adjusting, that adds a certain degree of uncertainty. Anytime you implement or take something out, and this was one of the problems of Obamacare, it came in with no warning. There was no chance to make plans. Like I said, it ruined us financially. I mean, I ended up pulling out my contributions to my retirement that I'd made for, you know, for a decade and everything. It destroyed us. Having said that, now that we've readjusted towards that, any readjustment back the other way is going to also, if it comes in this quickly and nobody knows what they're doing, and we're making this time of the year where you're making your plans, and if this is thrown out of kilter, that adds a certain degree of uncertainty. In other words, even if you're going to get rid of Obamacare, which I was always for getting rid of it, you still can't do it quickly. I mean, all of these things need to be incremental. They need to, so that people have time to plan. What are we doing next year? You know, all of these should take place over a 2 or 3 year period of time. And to throw something in this quickly is very, very dangerous at this time when people are making their plans.
Well, and I think the ACA wasn't really, I mean, I don't, you're right, it has completely changed.
Yes.
From what it was and the actual original intent on that. But, you know, we've talked in previous shows about the Senate reform bill, the Senate for criminal reform, and we talked about substance abuse and things like that. What I'm wondering is, with all of this, all of this, I guess, jockeying that we're seeing with the insurance companies wanting to offer less coverage and things like that, are we going to see a reduction not only in mental health services but mental health coverage after we just got it? You know what I mean? We've just been able to start recognizing mental health as an insurable ailment, I guess. And so how is that going to not only affect just regular people? I mean, forget the companies. How is this going to affect regular people who have been getting treatment, who have been having access to pharmaceuticals that they want or need? You know, how is that going to affect us there?
Well, it's like we said, the problem is the uncertainty, because everybody, you know, most people live close. And you have to think ahead, you know, how am I going to budget for this? How am I going to budget for this? How am I going to budget for this? And any dramatic change, people aren't ready for. Again, you know, people say, well, you should have planned ahead. Well, you can't plan ahead if you don't know what's coming next. In other words, so any change you're going to make has to be incremental, but that's not the way government operates. It's always
easy.
Draconian. It's always quickly.
It's easy to plan ahead when you're really financially stable.
Or when you know what's coming. And that's the problem with this. We don't know what's coming.
And most of us, I mean, we know that the majority of us are living check to check.
That's right.
That's not, we're not big CEOs that are making millions of dollars a year and driving all these fancy cars and all. I mean, the real people are going to be affected by these things that the upper class just, they don't feel it the same way that we do.
Neither do smaller employers. You know, and that's another thing that, you know, for a couple of years, they, you know, you had to provide this insurance for your employees and things like that, and or they could go through the marketplace. But with, and just like you say, just as an employer, as a small business, it is hard to kind of
understand, make an adjustment that quickly.
Well, yes. And because I want to be on the right side of Uncle Sam.
That's right.
I want to make sure that if I'm required to provide this, that I provide it. But I'm not going to, I don't want to fight that. I don't want, you know, I'm going to do whatever I've got to do, but I'm not, but it's just like taxes. I don't mind paying taxes. If that's some kind of employer mandate to where it says I have to provide insurance for my employees, you know what? They deserve that. I'm okay with that.
And if you have time to make those adjustments, in other words, if it's not just boom, here it is, you have to be able to plan ahead, to budget. And that's the problem with all these, whether we go one way or the other, is the changes come so quickly. And it just catches everybody off guard. And again, not just for individuals, as you said, for employers as well.
Now, is that correlated with the political pendulum that we experience and how fast this landscape changes with that? Because when the ACA was first implemented, the Democrats were in power. And then we had a Democratic president but a Republican Congress.
Well,
everything's Republican and the Democrats are still getting blamed.
And another problem basically is this. It's how the changes come about. You know, some of these changes, especially on how the law is going to be read, we leave it up to the courts, and the courts act quickly. You know, it's not like a legislature where you kind of figure out, well, what are we doing? And so these changes can come so quickly. A single court, you know, a single decision by a judge can change stuff overnight, and that's what's troubling. And again, I want to stress this. I wasn't for Obamacare, but for something to end that quickly, you know, I want it to end, but you've got to be able to plan ahead. You just can't, boom, make that change.
That is a really interesting point. Let's talk about Indian child welfare on that one, because, I mean, we are in a really precarious place with Indian child welfare. And Thomas talked to Oklahoma Indian Legal Services a couple of weeks ago about this very issue and how it affects Indian country and tribes being able to handle their own cases of child abuse and things like that.
Well, it almost turns into a sovereignty case because it's affecting the tribe's ability to do things and take care of their tribal members, that even if they're not living on tribal land, or even if, you know, as long as they're tribal members, that's the thing about it is, you know, the whole ICW, the idea of it was to take Indian kids and put them in either that same tribe's family, a family in within that tribe, and if they couldn't find a family within that tribe, then it would go to looking for another native family, and then it would go out to everybody else after that. And so them fighting that he really like compared it with the boarding schools and the taking away of the culture and the identity of these kids by putting them in a family that doesn't participate or doesn't know anything about the culture. And so it's a psychological thing for these kids because, I mean, you could ask any child psychologist, a kid that grows up with parents that don't look like him or her, are usually have a little bit of those identity issues, and that stuff has to be addressed. And, it's harder for non-native families to address that, to be able to teach this kid about where they're from. I mean, the simple stuff, like what we always talk about, like the creation stories. You know, everybody has their own creation story. Everybody has their own trickster stories and certain little words and stuff like that. And I've seen a lot of people that were adopted out to non-native families, and then when they get older, they want to retrace those roots, and then they're kind of shunned by everybody in the Indian community, because, you know, to everybody, like, in a place like Anadarko, it's just like, why you acting white? Why you coming around, you know? And so it's just, it's a tough deal on kids to be able to try to fit in like that. And it's crazy that this decision could just overturn all of that.
Well, and just on a side note, as a kid who grew up, I always feel like there are, when you're in an Indian family, you're in an Indian church family, or you're an Indian powwow family. And even though, like, my grandpa danced and, you know, went and participated in all that, we were a church family. And so, I mean, it's hard for a kid who's in a church family who didn't, I mean, you know, and it's not like I never went to powwows or anything like that, but I've never been to an actual 49. I know that's shocking to a lot of people, but, you know, I didn't really grow up like that. And to try to go into it now as an adult and everything, it is a little crazier to try to go back and try to go back to the powwows and the events and different things like that when you've been away for so long, and, you know, and you live this crazy life, and you're the way I am. You know, it is difficult. So it's not just non-native people. I mean, even natives within that community have a hard time getting back to that.
Well, see, that was a big part of that, trying to get the tribes to assimilate. That was an idea that was put in to people's minds by, you know, the government or schools or whatever like that. It was like, you were either civilized or you were not. And that was the way they looked. If you went to peyote meetings or sweat lodge or powwows or did, you know, ceremonials and stuff like that, you were uncivilized. You were pagan, heathen, you know, whatever other words, savage, you know, that they used to describe Indians. If you were, you know, you kept all your boys' hair cut short and you went to church and you worked a regular job and, you know, all that kind of stuff, then you were civilized. You were almost looked at, almost on the same level as them, you know, still not quite, but almost
one of the good ones.
Yeah. You know, kind of like the slave that got to work side by side with the slave master. You know what I mean? It's kind of like that same mentality where, oh, you're one of the good ones. But, you know, that was something that I was fortunate enough that, my family was both sides of it. And my dad's family was really traditional, but at the same time, my grandma was at church every Sunday, so she went to regular church. Where's Chapel Methodist? Every Sunday she was there. Every Sunday, Wednesday, I mean, choir, everything. But she was at every powwow around too, sitting right behind the drum, singing, buying raffle tickets, and, you know, everything else. And she would only cook fry bread outside on an open flame in cast iron skillet. You know, that's the only way she would do it. Like, if you didn't have Crisco, then she wasn't cooking fry bread. They always put that in our minds. You don't have to choose one or the other. And I was lucky enough that my dad was raised like that, that he was able to sing and dance at powwows and at the same time play culture, pop music, rock and roll and blues, and you know, started off playing gospel in church. But he was still all the traditional things that everybody thought of him as a Native American flute player and as, you know, a head singer at the drum or a dancer at the powwow or whatever it was. People knew him from both sides. And so that was something that I was raised with, that my mom was always there, like, you need to get your education, make sure you get your education, but at the same time, you need to make sure that you don't forget all this culture, where you come from, because that's what really makes you, and that's what sets us apart from most people in America, is that we really do still have a lot of our old culture. We still have language and stories and dances and stuff like that. You know, there's a lot of people that don't even know what region really they come from. So, you know, we have that positive thing, but at the same time, my dad used to always tell me, if you want to survive in the white man's world, you got to learn how to beat him at his own game. So you have to be in school. You have to learn, you know, math and science and all this other stuff to be able to survive in that world. But don't ever forget where you came from either. So,
and I think that's one of the reasons why this ICW, this Indian Child Welfare decision that has Indian country on pins and needles. I think that's, I mean, and I know this is kind of a crazy question, but I want to ask it for our listeners, Thomas. Why is it important for children to grow up in that, in their own culture like that, for Native kids?
Well, like I said, you know, it's really about being a part of something. I mean, being proud of who you are and where you come from. Like I said, you know, having a culture where, you know, my dad used to joke about white people, their culture was square dancing and, you know, stuff like that, you know. And he was like, they can't tell you any of their traditional dances from back where they're from. You know, a couple of them might have researched and do stuff like that. He said, but, you know, we're lucky because we're not that far removed, and we did keep a lot of that stuff. You know, not everybody was forced into boarding school. My dad was at the end of that, so he didn't have to go to Fort Sill like his older brothers and sisters did. That's probably why my dad, out of three boys, was the only one that kept long hair, because both of my older uncles, went to Fort Sill Indian School, and so that was, you know, that was the places where they used to get beat for speaking their language or for praying in the way that they wanted to pray or for singing their songs or any of that stuff. They would get beat, you know, beaten pretty good. And that's the kind of stuff that made my dad want to pass that on to us more, because his older brothers and sisters paid the price for that. You know, they were the ones that had to take the brunt of that. And he, you know, just barely got right in that in-between time where he didn't have to get sent off, you know, that he could just go to Broxton right there out in, you know, out in the country. So, you know, the part about knowing your culture and knowing where you come from.
That's it. You need to have a sense of place. There's always this notion, if you're a part of everything, you're a part of nothing. I mean, there should be something that's special to you.
Yeah.
I mean, again, because you have to be able to define yourself. If not, you'll look for it in false places.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we apply like this philosophy? I mean, we all obviously agree that there is a level of that. So how do we convey that to our elected officials? I mean, to make the right decisions. I mean, because it's like I said, these decisions are just, especially for any country.
This is a problem we've talked about before at with national politics. Everything comes out of Washington. And we've seen, even when you get into locales, I mean, we're losing regional distinctions. I mean, this is one that affects both natives and non-natives. I mean, you know, I grew up in the South. I'm a Southerner, and the point is, that's a bad word nowadays. I mean, you know, for me, it's not. I mean, you know, I'm proud of what I am. I mean, you know, again, there's negative and there's positive, but you should be aware of it. I mean, at least and stuff. And so, but for me, you know, I mean, you know, we have this idea now that they have what they even when I was in school, when I was in high school, when I was in college, there was this idea when I went into education. Well, you need to speak, you know, standard English. Not regional English, not dialect, and they would try to get rid of it, and that's wrong. You know, and once upon a time, if you go back to Shakespearean English, they liked the dialect. They liked accents. It gave you a sense of your place and everything. And to have this notion that you have to have this cookie cutter, this, I guess everybody is supposed to speak Midwestern, you know.
Now. Right. We all got to be from Minnesota. Eh?
It doesn't cut it. I mean, you know, everybody should have, people should be able, they should be proud of who they are.
Well, and that brings a really interesting point to, of course, you know, Indians, we don't trust nothing about Washington. Not Washington, mm-hmm. D.C. We just, anytime somebody says Washington, our eyes glaze over, it's like, nope. But, you know, but really, I mean, how do we continue to bring these issues to light to make sure that, and again, you know, just like you say with non-natives, non-natives understand the importance of the Indian child welfare and the importance of children, you know, having that kind of cultural education that they get and things like that. So how do we, it's like I said, how do we as individuals convey this importance to the people who are the decision makers?
Well, and first of all, we have to be, they've got to learn. We always think we have to learn to speak their language. They have to be able to speak our language. The only thing they understand is money.
Unfortunately.
And so when they look at something, they think, well, a program, how much money can we have a lot? And what they don't understand is, you know, there's a certain amount of cultural autonomy that people want. That's what you want, a way to decide what is best for us. It's not just about money. And that's the thing in Washington, that's the only calculation they understand is money.
So is that one of the reasons why our society has so divided itself between Democrat and Republican and independent and libertarian? I mean, unless you're identifying as one of those, then we really don't know.
That's it.
Who instead of the regional,
think how artificial parties are.
Yes.
And how dangerous if that's and again it gets back to if you're part of everything, you're part of nothing. Mm-hmm. Well, a party wants this national identity. You know, if somebody says I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat, that's beyond region, and there's something, you know, there's something, I don't know, that kind of
it's cultish.
It takes a soul away.
It's cultish.
Basically, yeah, it is.
Well,
it is cultish.
It takes me back to a conversation that Dr. Crowe and I actually had about the perfect size for a government to operate at a highly, to function. And what did you say it was about 5,000?
5,000's ideal, and it really gets hard above, you know, once you get above 300,000, it gets very hard.
And that lends to what you're talking about, because there's so much difference in region from place to place in America. And it's not just I know you talked about the language, and I remember a trip one time whenever we flew from Oklahoma, we did a show in Boston, in Baston.
You know?
Yeah.
we went from there and went down to Atlanta, down to Georgia, and then we flew back and then went out to Gallup, New Mexico, and the difference in the regional dialect from place to place, and the food, you know, all the natural seafood and all that kind of the fresh seafood and all that stuff up there. And then we get down to Atlanta and they're, you know, cooking Southern, you know, home cooking and like gumbo and stuff like that. And then you go out to Gallup and they're cooking mutton and
tamales.
Pueblo bread.
It's these things that actually bring real stability, a real sense of place. If we focus just on economics, well, here's the thing. We talked about this earlier. You know, is there a crisis coming and all this? The one thing you can always say is in the future, there is always an economic crisis coming. And if that hits and we have nothing to fall back on, no community, no sense of place, think about how violent things become. You know, one of the things that a civilization, a culture does is it gives you etiquette, it gives you rules, it gives you a way to relate to your fellows that's beyond just material stuff. And if that's taken away, then we're just animals looking for stuff. And we're more than that. I mean, basically, culture, you know, your sense of place, that's what defines you as a person. And without that, then we're just a bunch of sociopaths.
Hey, I agree with that 100%. Here's another thing that I wonder, too, is that, you know, with all of this crazy tariffs and the import and export and how big that is in our, you know, GDP and all this kind of stuff, would it behoove us just to, like, grow this stuff for our own population instead of, like,
well,
sending it out and bringing it back? I mean, couldn't we just do that and,
not
like,
just
make
that,
more sense?
Even going a step further than that, this is one thing that particularly some tribes are going to almost lead the way in that if you think about internationally how we've become with agriculture, how we have basically, if you take Monsanto, all these large companies and stuff, how they get down to these certain seeds that you have to have certain fertilizers for and all this. And we've basically reduced ourselves to maybe just a few variety of seeds.
Yes.
And if is all it takes is one great blight for us to end up like the Irish in 1848, where you wipe out all the crops.
Yep.
There are some groups, like the Choctaws and others, that have preserved some of these native seeds.
Pawnees. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
With our blue corn.
And that's it. And so the fact is, that's about all that's out there now. to fall back on. And so the fact that they have held on to this cultural tradition may end up literally saving their lives, literally maybe saving all kinds of people's lives.
Well, I've been seeing this a lot among the natives, like on Facebook that I'm friends with and stuff like that. The amount of natives that have their own gardens that are growing their own food for themselves or just their, you know, their family, their community or whatever. They have these gardens where they're growing their own corn and tomatoes and whatever they can grow at that place. But, you know, at the same time, you're taking all the, you know how they do the whole GMO and all that kind of stuff, all the fertilizers. Yeah, more control over. And it's the same way with medical patients growing their own marijuana, because you have complete control from seed to the time that you're going to consume it over what goes into it, how it was handled, if it was washed right, if it was, you're going to know if your lettuce is contaminated with E. coli. You know what I mean? You're not worried about wastewater from the cattle next door or whatever, because that's not what you're, you know, that's not what you're doing. So, I mean, even the old, like, the native tobacco that's used in a lot of ceremonies, there's a lot of people that are growing their own native tobacco. There's people that have a lot of these plants that you use for some of our medicines that are still around. You know, the Indian medicines, the what they call holistic healing, or I guess they haven't found the right chemical compound to put it into scientific terms for what's actually going on. But it's stuff that we've been using for years to treat different symptoms. So I think you're seeing a lot of that with the native populations, that people that that rely on hunting a lot of the time of the year to put food away and stock their freezers and make dried meat. And we're almost seeing a renaissance of that.
Food sovereignty among native tribes is huge. Mm-hmm. And, you know, especially like he said, with subsistence tribes up in the mm-hmm. Northwest, I mean, you have to mm-hmm. Look towards sustainability. You have to look toward, you have to accept climate change for what it is, where you're at. And kind of change that. But one of the most important aspects of the Pawnee Seed Preservation Project is having that tie back to our homeland in Nebraska, having that education and teaching our young people about it. And they even actually, I mean, it's a commercial thing. Mm-hmm. They sell bags of it. It's flour. Oh, yeah. It's huge. So I think that, and I think you're right, Dr. Crow, I think the tribes are really going to lead the way, because they're already raising their own holistic crops. They're already going back to what they were surviving on.
Think about the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes, who have their own buffalo herd, where they butcher buffalo periodically throughout the year, and then their diabetes wellness program distributes the bison meat to the elders. And so you're not only providing food at no cost for your tribal members, but you're providing them healthier food, because bison is so less fatty than regular beef. You can cook all the same stuff with it. You couldn't tell the difference. They gave me some, and I went and cooked lasagna with it. My kids tore that stuff up. They didn't know it was buffalo, you know? And I mean, and it's healthier.
Well, and that's getting back to what we survived on. That was the food that our genetics say, you know, that's what you need. So mm-hmm. it's really interesting that, yeah, food sovereignty is, like I said, it's going to be a huge thing. And I do think it's going to come into play a lot here in the next probably 5 or 10 years with the shortages that we're already seeing. So very fascinating today. Thank you so much for tuning in to this edition of The Crow's Nest. Be sure to join us every Saturday at noon. And if you miss an episode, all you got to do is go on the Talk Jive homepage at talkjive.org, click on the podcast tab, and you can search any of the episodes right there, all of the past ones, with one click. For me, Kelly J. Lewis, Thomas Ware III, and Dr. Kevin Crow, thank you so much. We'll catch you back here next Saturday at noon. Have a great day, everyone.